the headlines, the Israeli military raids the offices of Palestinian human rights groups in the occupied West Bank as the regime keeps up with its atrocities. Britain is bracing for massive industrial strikes as millions are struggling to pay their energy bills and put food on the table. And China slams plans for fresh U.S.-Taiwan trade talks, warning it will take firm measures to defend its sovereignty. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. The Israeli regime releases footage of its forces raiding the offices of Palestinian human rights groups in the occupied West Bank. The military says it closed seven institutions and confiscated property during the overnight raids. Senior Palestinian Authority official censured the raids as an attempt to silence the voice of truth and justice. Israel has labeled six Palestinian rights groups, quote, terrorist organizations, without providing evidence for its allegations. The regime recently passed into law the terror designation of three of those rights groups. Last month, nine member states of the European Union, among them France and Germany, issued a joint statement saying they would continue to cooperate with those six groups. A statement cited lack of substantial information to justify the designation of those groups as the reason behind the decision. Earlier, we talked to our correspondent in Ramallah, Muna Kendall, for more details about the Israeli raids on Palestinian rights offices in the occupied West Bank.
The Israeli military closed and confiscated equipment from seven Palestinian Palestinian civil society and human rights organizations. Well, we have to mention, as you have said, six of these organizations that were raided on Thursday had been outlawed by Israel as a terrorist organization. Those organizations include Al-Damir Prisoner Support and the Human Rights Association. It works, of course, with the Palestinian prisoners and the prisoners' issue. There's also Al-Haq Rights Group, the Union Palestinian Women Committees. There's also the Union of Agricultural Work Committees, Bissan Center for Research and Development, Palestine chapter of the Geneva-based Defense for Children International, DCI, this organization that works to follow up the issue of Palestinian children, the prisoners, of course, children, as well as the Palestinian children who are wounded and injured by the Israeli military. The seventh organization that was shot down today, and it's not included in the list seen by Israel as terrorists, is the Union of Health Work Committees.
Iran's foreign minister has reiterated that the revival of the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA hinges on respecting the Islamic Republic's red lines. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made these comments in a phone call with his Omani counterpart, Badr al-Abu Saidi. The top Iranian diplomat said Tehran must also be able to reap the economic benefits of a revived agreement. Earlier this week, Iran provided the EU with its final conclusion on the talks aimed at salvaging the pact. Tehran says it is now Washington's turn to show flexibility and take a realistic approach if it really wants a final agreement. The U.S. sent the deal into limbo after unilaterally pulling out of it in 2018 and reimposing sanctions on Iran. Talks have been held among the remaining signatories since April last year to rescue the accord. Britain's faced hardships getting around the country as railway staff once again walk out over pay. The industrial action by thousands of rail workers is the latest in a wave of strikes nationwide this summer. The walkout is set to be repeated on Saturday. Meanwhile, workers at London Underground, as well as the city's bus network personnel, will go on strike on Friday. Other sectors are expected to stage walkouts as well. British postal workers employed by the Royal Mail have reportedly planned a four-day strike from the end of August. British workers are discontented with their wages. They say their salary does not keep pace with the rising prices in the country. Experts warn of an autumn of discontent as the Bank of England has predicted inflation will top the 13% mark later this year. China has warned the United States against signing any agreements with the Chinese Taipei. This after Washington announced plans for trade talks with the island.
China always opposes any country to negotiate or sign any commercial and trade agreements with sovereign connotations or of an official nature with the Taiwan region of China. We demand concrete actions from the U.S. side to strictly abide by the One China principle and the three Sino-U.S. joint communique, stop any form of official exchanges between the U.S. and Taiwan, and refrain from negotiating or signing agreements with the Taiwan region of China that have sovereign connotations or an official nature, and refrain from using economic and trade means to send any wrong signals to the Taiwan independent forces. Do not make mistakes again and again.
The Chinese official warned his country will take firm measures against violating the Chinese sovereignty. U.S. officials say negotiations with Taiwan would cover a host of areas, including agriculture, digital trade, regulatory prices, and removing trade barriers. Taiwan says it is expecting extended economic collaboration with the U.S., but its largest trading partner by far remains China. Chinese officials have shown a flurry of stern reactions over the U.S.-Taiwan relations. Beijing says Washington's provocative actions threaten peace in Southeast Asia. Turkey has gone ahead with its offensive in northern Syria. The attacks took place near the town of Kobani between Turkish soldiers and U.S.-backed Kurdish militants. This has raised the prospect of a war as the Syrian army has vowed to directly respond to Turkish attacks on its soil.
Tensions are rising between Turkey and Syria. Ankara has launched airstrikes on military posts in northern Syria, killing several army soldiers and injuring several more. There are now concerns that a military operation in northern Syria by Turkish forces is imminent. Sources say a new cross-border offensive by Turkey looms large. Turkish forces have reportedly used loudspeakers in mosques in border areas close to the Jarabulus city to ask people to stay indoors in preparation for the operation. Reports also say numerous Turkish combat drones could be seen flying in the skies over areas in proximity to the frontier. Turkish soldiers are also mobilizing in most of the border towns of Hasaka, Raqqa, and Aleppo provinces. The Turkish president has already hinted at a possible military incursion. On August 8th, Recep Tayyip Erdogan said Ankara's decision to establish a 30-kilometer deep secure line along the country's southern border is final. Ankara says it's going to curb Kurdish militants operating in that area.
They want actually to annex the northern part of Syria. This is an ambition that that Turkey has to regain, to enlarge some territory that it once had. And I think this is not something that is acceptable either to Syria or even to Russia. Russia wants to have good relations with Turkey, but not at this price, I think.
The U.S.-backed Kurdish People's Protection Unit, or YPG, militant group, which is the backbone of SDF, is present there. Ankara says YPG militants are terrorists. Damascus has warned Ankara against violating its sovereignty. Both Iran and Russia, which have been aiding Damascus in its anti-terror campaign, are also against Turkey's possible offensive. Turkey has deployed forces in Syria in violation of the Arab country's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Ankara-backed militants were deployed to northeastern Syria in October 2019. Back then, Turkish forces launched a cross-border invasion to push YPG militants away. Since 2016, Turkey has launched three military operations inside Syria.
Turkey has reiterated its intention to create a 30-kilometer safe zone in northern Syria. In that case, it would overtake Kobani and other towns held by the so-called U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces. This would then bring Turkey into direct conflict with the U.S. Therefore, by default, it is the U.S. that is the sort of instability. Washington has not only maintained its illegal presence in Syria, but keeps supporting Kurdish fighters and stealing Syrian oil.
When the crisis began on Syria in 2011, Ankara backed militants fighting against the government in Damascus. For years, it provided them with weapons and military support in a bid to topple the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad.
So this is perhaps just what we sometimes call a red herring, that is something that will distract the observers from what is actually going on. It makes it appear, makes Turkey appear to be reasonable, when in fact they don't have a reasonable agenda at all. They have an unreasonable agenda.
However, there are signs that Turkey may have changed its policy on Syria. Just recently, it was revealed that the Turkish foreign minister had a brief conversation with his Syrian counterpart last October. The top Turkish diplomat has stressed that there needs to be a reconciliation between opposition groups and the Damascus government. There are reports that Ankara was evaluating the possibility of starting talks with the Syrian government. The leader of Turkey's Nationalist Movement Party has also supported comments to mend relations with neighboring Syria. Turkey now appears to be in a difficult position. The country's economy is now in its worst situation in decades. It's spending nearly $2 billion in northern Syria annually. And sentiments against Syrian refugees in Turkey are rising. That could potentially cost Erdogan his political career. In order to fix it, Erdogan needs to establish relations with Syria.
I think it's going to be a major problem. The Turkish attack indicates that they are not going to accept a reasonable compromise and to respect the territorial integrity of Syria. So this is going to be a major problem.
But at the same time, Ankara does not want to lose Syria card with regards to anti-Assad militants. However, its possible military adventure in northern Syria could trigger another catastrophe in a country which is in the midst of a prolonged crisis.
The Malian foreign minister accuses France of supporting terrorist groups in his country, where Paris maintained its military presence until a few days ago. In a letter to the UN Security Council, he calls for an urgent meeting in order to Bamako present evidence. It says that France fighter jets, drones and military helicopters breach Mali's airspace more than 50 times this year. The letter says that those flagrant violations were used by France to collect intelligence for terrorist groups operating in the Sahel region and to drop arms and ammunition for them. France has rejected the allegation, which comes just days after it announced the final withdrawal of forces from Mali. France deployed troops to its former colony under the pretext of fighting terrorism, but many Malians consider the mission a failure. India has decided to put Rohingya refugees at a detention center before deporting them to Myanmar, despite an earlier promise to provide them with shelter and security. The Federal Home Ministry, in a statement, had designated the Rohingya illegal foreigners. And that hours after a minister of housing and urban affairs outlined a plan to resettle the stateless Muslims to a remote area. The plan was seen a potential change in the government's critical stance towards the refugee group. There are an estimated 40,000 Rohingyas in India, On Wednesday, UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet said it remained unsafe for the Rohingya to go back home in Myanmar. In the past, India faced severe criticism from the UN and rights groups after Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government tried to repatriate Rohingyas, citing security threats. Several blazes engulfing shantytowns in Delhi also exposed the plight of the refugees. Hundreds of thousands of Rohingyas fled the country after Myanmar's army launched a deadly crackdown in 2017. North Korea has launched two cruise missiles as South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol marks 100 days in office. The launch has also come one day after preliminary joint U.S.-South Korea military drills began in preparation for large-scale field exercises set to start on August the 22nd. Frank Smith reports.
North Korea launched two cruise missiles into nearby waters early Wednesday morning, according to South Korean military officials. The missile shots follow South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol's offer of substantial aid with one condition. Pyongyang must give up its nuclear weapons program.
We will help the North every way we can. If the country shows us its commitment to complete denuclearization, I think we need to provide an agenda first so that we can wait for its answer. And this will also enable us to have meaningful talks with North Korea in the future for the establishment of peace on the Korean Peninsula.
Some South Koreans view the previous summits between progressive former President Moon Jae-in and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un as empty shows for the cameras. For North Korea, the offer of aid from the conservative new President Yoon suffers from questionable timing.
Coupled with the fact that South Korea and the U.S. are about to stage war games, it seems highly unlikely that North Korea is even going to respond to South Korea's offer. The U.S. and South Korea have not staged field exercises in years, and obviously North Korea is outraged at what's going to happen.
The U.S. and South Korea have been engaging in frequent small-scale military drills since South Korean President Yoon took office. The joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises are scheduled to begin on August 22nd and will be the largest in about 4 years. Pyongyang views the drills as a rehearsal for invasion. This year's maneuvers will include an amphibious landing. The upcoming drills will also involve a U.S. aircraft carrier strike group and strategic weapons. The South's Yoon also said he hoped to strengthen the U.S. extended deterrence commitment to defend South Korea with nuclear weapons. Frank Smith, Seoul.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
A choice between austerity and populist bigotry is a brutal one, and it portends a bleak immediate future for government in the UK, says David Renton Ryder in an article published under the heading, "The contest to replace Boris Johnson is a choice between austerity and bigotry." Stay tuned for more. Boris Johnson's government will go down in history as a record breaker, just not, however, for achievements of which any prime minister will be proud. His government began badly. On being appointed prime minister, he suffered a series of defeats in the House of Commons. In the British Constitution, prime ministers are not directly elected but hold office by virtue of their ability to command the confidence of Parliament. If a government cannot sustain a majority in the Commons, it is supposed to resign. Johnson lost his first 4 votes in Parliament and 12 altogether in autumn 2019. Over the next 2 years, Johnson cut spending on health and education, awarded billions in government contracts to his allies, and presided over a COVID pandemic in which Britain had among the worst death rates in Europe. Johnson's government ended even worse than it began. In a 2-day period between July 5th to 7th this year, 57 government ministers resigned rather than serve under him. Never before in British history had so many senior members of the executive quit at once. For all his reputation as the great survivor of British politics, he's now leaving power, and the race is underway to select his successor. The winner will be chosen by Conservative Party members by public vote from a list of 2 candidates, with the winner to be announced on September 5th. Rishi Sunak, previously the Chancellor of the Exchequer, and Liz Truss, the Foreign Secretary. In theory, Sunak should be the favorite, as he has held senior office for longer and was nominated by a much larger number of Conservative members of Parliament. Sunak is the richest MP in the House of Commons as a result of his marriage to the Indian heiress Akshata Murthy, whose father, N.R. Narayana Murthy, often called the Indian Bill Gates, founded the Indian tech company Infos. Sunak has long been criticized for the way he and his wife handled that family business, which included his wife declaring herself a non-domiciled resident of England while he was a chancellor to avoid paying taxes. Sunak takes into leadership content 1 defining policy, which is that Britain overspent during the COVID crisis and now needs to work hard and make sacrifices. Sunak resigned as Chancellor because of Johnson's lack of support for budget cuts, setting in motion the series of resignations which led to Johnson's removal. This idea is especially important since gas and electricity companies are expected to hike energy rates by 70% for most households, a sum large enough to force millions into poverty. Johnson has refused to set in place any protection for those affected before he leaves office. If elected, Sunak would offer the victims of those price increases nothing. Sunak is not exactly a social liberal, but he does not appear to be comfortable playing the role of a populist. Late in the contest, he delivered a speech warning about work nonsense, but this was given later and very obviously in response to what is perceived to be Truss's success in wooing the Conservative base. In contrast to her, Sunak represents a return to the politics of austerity that dominated in Britain before 2016 and whose wider unpopularity popularity created the internal revolt in conservative politics that was expressed in Brexit and the rise of Johnson. Liz Truss, by contrast, has portrayed herself as a continuity pro-Johnson candidate. In days when neo-Nazis have been picketing public libraries and demanding the cancelling of story times hosted by drag queens, Truss has tried to claim the leadership of the anti-immigration policies. Truss also promises to support and extend Boris Johnson's plans to rip up the UN Refugee Convention by deporting refugees to Rwanda. Like Sunak, Truss has nothing to offer the victims of rising fuel prices. Unlike him, however, she argues there is an alternative of sorts to rising inflation and falling living standards. Truss insists that rather than cap prices or limit the profits of the oil giant companies, what the government should be doing is slashing taxes for the richest people in society. She represents herself as the enemy of financial experts and businesses, a message amplified by her supporters who contrast Sunak's £450 shoes to Truss's £4.50 earrings. But this look is about positioning, not helping the poor. Another of Truss's big ideas was to pay for those tax cuts by cutting the pay of some of Britain's worst paid public sector workers. Truss has termed campaigners calling for a Green New Deal militant activist and pledged to press on with the Conservative plans to criminalise protest. Boris Johnson had already published plans to water down Britain's Human Rights Act, which requires governments at all levels to behave in a way consistent with essential rights. Truss promises to abandon that human rights framework altogether. Such policies have made Truss Deb Wookie's clear favourite to win. Like many other countries right now, Britain has the feel of Europe after the First World War, with conservatives pushing the fantasy that what they need is some kind of elected dictator without any of the post-war checks or balances that they used to think were at the core of democracy and who, by some act of magic, would solve the difficult crises around them. And yet Truss is in many ways an unlikely candidate. While some have compared her to Margaret Thatcher, who paved the way for the Conservatives' post-1979 hegemony by defeating the country's unions, privatizing much of the welfare state and making privatization briefly a popular cause, a much more likely comparison is Theresa May, who was welcomed into office with press headlines predicting a period of authoritarian right-wing government, crush the saboteurs, only to be defeated at the first moment she had to test those policies on voters. A choice between austerity and populist bigotry is a brutal one, and it portends a bleak immediate future for government in the UK.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now let's listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
My dear brothers and sisters in Iman, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. This evening, as we continue in our remembrance and the commemoration of the tragedy of Karbala and the supreme sacrifice of Aba Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam and his family and friends, we mark this plateau of what we call the 10th, the Dasmo of the Imam. And we recognize the fact, first and foremost, that these events that we have, for example, the 10th, the 20th, the 30th, they don't have a historical significance to them. It's not like the day of Ashura, which was foretold by Rasulullah. It's not like Muharram, the day of Ashura, which the Imams of Ahlul Bayt would remember and actively remember and teach their children to commemorate. But yet these events, again, the 10th, the 20th, the 30th, as we lead up to the day of Arba'in, the Chelum, that these are opportunities that we have put within our community to remember the tragedy of Karbala, to keep the message of Abu Abdullah alayhi salam alive, and to be able to hopefully gain from the teachings of the Quran and Ali Muhammad alayhi wassalatu wassalam. In chapter number 21, which is Surah Al-Anbiya, in verse number 18, Allah alludes to this reality. And He says in the text, He says, بَلْ نَقْتِفُ بِالْحَقِّ عَلَى الْبَاطِلِ فَيَدْمَغُهُ فَإِذَا هُوَ زَاهِقٌ وَلَكُمْ وَيْلٌ مِمَّا تَصِفُونَ. He says that we hurl truth against falsehood. We take truth and we thrust it, or we throw it against falsehood, Allah says, and we crush the head of falsehood, of batil. We destroy falsehood in its totality. And then He says that falsehood will eventually vanish. So this is a reality, brothers and sisters, that no matter how long it may take, no matter what the challenges and difficulties are in human existence, that falsehood, as Allah says, will eventually vanish. It will be subdued. It will be taken over by the light of the truth. And indeed, when we study Karbala in these opportunities that we have, from those first 10 or 11 or 12 days of Muharram all the way till the day of Arba'in, we recognize the fact that truth conquered over falsehood. Although, yes, Abu Abdullah and the family and companions, as we mentioned, were, and as we all know, were killed on the day of Ashura, but that doesn't diminish the fact that they set the ball in motion that the earlier prophets had put into place, that Rasulullah had put into motion, that the father, Amir al-Mu'mineen, had manifest, that Imam Hassan alayhi salam had put in. And then that will obviously continue until the end, until the return of the 12th Imam, Imam al-Hujjah, ajjalallahu ta'ala, farajuhu sharif. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. And in our case, it's not even just a battle of families, you know, because some people have tried to play this off as a battle between Banu Umayyah and Banu Hashim. And if you study the history of these two families, you see how close they are related, because you have Rasulullah on one end of the family tree. If you go back to the great-grandfather of Rasulullah, so that's going back three generations, the father of the Prophet, his grandfather, his great-grandfather. You have Banu Hashim that come from that lineage. And if you look at the great-great-great-grandfather of the Prophet, so four generations up, he has twins. One is Hashim, one is Abdul Shams. From Hashim, you get the Banu Hashim, the family of Rasulullah. From Abdul Shams, if you go down the other tree, you get Umayyah and his family. So you have Banu Umayyah. So actually, the rivalry, we can say, was a one-sided rivalry, which began with Abdul Shams and his son Umayyah, and their animosity for Hashim and his family. And there is a lot of historical background. I won't go into it tonight, maybe another night, but there's a historical understanding why there was this rivalry between Abdul Shams and Umayyah and Banu Hashim. And even, you know, people have asked, well, how did Muawiyah get so powerful in Sham? How did Yazid, or why did they even go to Sham? And there's a historical background that goes back to the time of Abdul Shams and Umayyah and Hashim, and why they ended up in Sham, and why they gained popularity and notoriety, and allowed and facilitated people like Muawiyah to take the governorship of that region. But basically, this entire tragedy of Karbala, haq against batil, really begins four generations before the coming of Rasulullah. And that basically continued and manifested into what we see on the plains of Karbala in the year 61 after the Hijrah. Now, obviously, I want to fast forward to the event that we want to mark tonight, which is this 10th of the Shuhada of Karbala. And as I said, that it's From the Quranic perspective, although the Quran is not giving us historical narrative just to analyze or know history, but we can gain an insight from the Quranic verses about the history of past generations and how we understand the world of Abu Abdullah alayhi salam and where we are tonight. But you know, as we commemorate this 10th of the Imam, the 10 days after the day of Ashura, we all know, and I will remind us if we have forgotten, that the tragedies of Ali Muhammad didn't end on Ashura. The tragedies of Ali Muhammad, yes, the Shahadats or the Shuhada had lost their lives, but death in a way is easy, you know, because once you're dead, that's it. Then your soul goes back to Allah. As Surah Al-Fajr would say, Ya ayatuha nafsul mutma'inna, irji'i ila rabbiki radiyatan mardiyah. That return back to your Lord, pleased with Allah and Him being pleased with you. Shahada is easy, but what happened to Bibi Zainab alayhi salam, what happened to Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, what happened to the women, what happened to the children, from the 10th of Muharram all the way to the day of Arba'een, we can never forget, brothers and sisters. And it is in these days after Ashura that we remember the fact that after the tragedy of Karbala, as the caravan has been forced to leave Karbala, as they cross through the bloodstained plains of Karbala, as Imam Zain al-Abidin, as he's walking, or if, as some narrations say, he's on the camel, and he looks down, and he sees the mutilated body of his father, Abu Abdullah, the lifeless body, the headless body, the one that had been trampled by the horses, those 10 horses that had been forced to crush the ribcage of Abu Abdullah, that Abu Abdullah's body lays on the plains of Karbala. The enemies have given a burial to their soldiers, but there is nobody there to bury Abu Abdullah. That Imam Sajjad alayhi salam looks off of the camel to the body of his father. And what can he do in the state that he's in? وَسَيَعْلَمُ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا أَيَّ مُنْقَلِبٍ يَنْقَلِبُونَ إِنَّ لِلَّهِ وَإِنَّ إِلَيْهِ رَاجِعُونَ
اللهم اجعل محياي محيا محمد وآل محمد ومماتي ممات محمد وآل محمد. To Allah, whenever I face troubles in my life, I close my eyes and see your shrine and call the back every time. Oh, Hussein, you're the love of my heart. You are the light of my eyes. I swear to Allah, until my last breath, I will remember Hussein.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. English Radio.
in the limelight.
Drought was declared in 8 of England's 14 regions recently after a meeting of the National Drought Group, made up of ministers, civil servants, water companies and conservation groups. 5 water areas have so far put in place hosepipe bans, though farmers have called for more as ministers were briefed that farmers face the ruin of up to half their crops. We now present you an article written by Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled England Failing to Invest in Water Networks to Avoid Future Droughts. The UK's infrastructure chief has warned England is failing to invest in the water networks needed to avoid a future of recurrent serious droughts, with current policies amounting to the government keeping its fingers crossed. Sir John Ahmed, chair of the National Infrastructure Commission, said, with more hot dry spells interspersed with heavier rainfall, the current drought was a warning that water systems could not cope with the changing climate. He warned, investment is better than keeping your fingers crossed and relying on emergency measures. He said ministers could not prevent dry weather, but they could direct investment into infrastructure to cope with it, such as reservoirs and cutting wastage. Sir John Ahmed added, the government should set out what degree of risk from drought they would see as reasonable for people to manage and expect. He warned water bills may have to increase to pay for the investment needed. Sir John Ahmed told The Guardian in an interview, if you want greater resilience to drought, then you have to increase water bills or general taxation to pay for it. Drought was declared in 8 of England's 14 regions recently after a meeting of the National Drought Group, made up of ministers, civil servants, water companies and conservation groups. 5 water areas have so far put in place hosepipe bans, though farmers have called for more, as ministers were briefed that farmers face the ruin of up to half their crops. In several areas in the drought-stricken south of England, people have been forced to queue in the street as their water systems failed. In the village of North End in Oxfordshire, people have been relying on tankers. In and around Guildford in Surrey, handouts of bottled water began at the weekend after a pump failure at Netley Mill Treatment Works. In Everton in Bedfordshire, an already unreliable supply has been further threatened by drought. Hydrologists have claimed these are isolated incidents and that measures such as standpipes, a vivid memory for some from the last most serious drought in 1976, were highly unlikely to be needed in the current drought, as water companies were more resilient and better prepared than they were nearly half a century ago. The National Infrastructure Commission has estimated the cost of overhauling the UK's water networks at £20 billion by 2050, considerably less than the £27 billion the government has earmarked for new roads this Parliament, which campaigners say are not needed. Sir John Ahmed said this cost was dwarfed by the cost of drought. He warned, in increasingly frequent droughts, you'll probably have to spend twice that much on bottled water from the back of lorries. He said new reservoirs should be strongly considered, despite the difficulty of obtaining planning permission, particularly in the southeast of England. In an interview with The Guardian, he noted water metering was also likely to be needed to encourage people to cut their usage of water, but the government is not keen. Sir John Ahmed, chair of the National Infrastructure Commission, called for a national debate on how to fund water improvements. The two Tory leadership candidates, Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak, have called for action but shied away from setting out clear proposals on investment. Sir John Ahmed asked, "You have to balance water investment. Do you put it back through people's bills or through general taxation?" adding, "You have to ensure poor people are not being penalised." He said the role of water companies should be scrutinised. He noted, "There has been criticism of water companies paying dividends to investors. That has to be an issue for governments and regulators to decide." He added, "You can argue that water companies have invested too little. Going forward, the real challenge is for government to say what level of performance the public should be entitled to expect." People could have a substantial impact on water usage by changing their behaviour, for instance, by not leaving taps running and running washing machines only on full loads. But Sir John Ahmed warned this would not be enough alone, and the government under a new Prime Minister would face uncomfortable choices over the investment needed for new reservoirs and new infrastructure. He said, "There is a cost of living crisis, especially with energy bills, and people don't want to hear about water bills going up too." He added, "But one way or another, we have to find a way to pay for this new infrastructure." Sir John Ahmed added, "Poorer households could be protected if the government stepped in to make the current billing systems fairer." England has experienced its driest July since 1911, with only about 10% of the average rainfall for the time of year in the south of England. The period since November has been the driest 8-month period in England since 1976. After a dry spell for almost 50 years, the United Kingdom is now being warned to expect flooding from thundery showers that will offer little relief from the drought. The flood alert follows days of extreme heat warnings and the official declaration of a drought after the longest 9-month dry spell since 1976. Meteorologists warned that downpours are the wrong kind of rain to tackle the drought and are more likely to lead to flash floods from water running off parched earth. The heat wave is forecast to break with a yellow warning for thunderstorms covering almost all of the United Kingdom, all of England and Wales, and most of southern and eastern England in the coming days. The Meteorological Office warned of torrential downpours and possible disruption in some spots, adding that homes and businesses could be flooded quickly and buildings damaged by floodwater. It also said power cuts were possible. The Environment Agency also warned that properties could flood and travel could be disrupted by surface water. John Curtin, the agency's executive director of operations, tweeted that the United Kingdom was in that twilight zone of having both flood and drought warnings. He said heavy thundery rain on parched and hard ground would lead to rapid runoff and heightened flood risk in the coming days. But this will in no way correct weeks of dry weather, so most of England will remain in drought. Professor Hannah Cloke, an expert in hydrology at the University of Reading, said the forecast rain was unlikely to be long-lasting or widespread enough to make a big difference to some exceptionally low levels in reservoirs and rivers. Dan Stroud, a forecaster at the Meteorological Office, said, "We're coming to the end of an extended very hot spell, and the ground has been baked, so it's extremely dry. The weather is breaking down into a mixture of heavy and thundery showers." Dan Stroud added, and rain from really intense downpours will be unable to soak into the baked ground quickly. It's very difficult for the water to actually get in because it has to force the air out of the soil. So dry ground gets very quickly overwhelmed and we then get surface runoff. He added, what we really need is a continuous period of light rain or drizzle just to gently re-wet the soil. Intense downpours are not exceptionally helpful. It's going to take a lot of rain over an extended period of time to actually recharge the aquifers and reservoirs. Dan Stroud added, almost anywhere was at risk of the impact of thundery downpours, but it was difficult to pinpoint exactly where. He said, Scotland and Northern Ireland were most at risk. The risk develops initially across Wales and the southwest of England, and then more widely across England during the coming days. Rob Thompson, who conducted the demonstration, said, dry, parched ground doesn't let water in as effectively as already moist ground because the soil is resisting water entering. The water sits on the surface to run off down slopes or simply sit in a pool. Three water companies, Welsh Water, Southern Water and South East Water, have imposed hosepipe bans, while Yorkshire Water has announced that a ban will start on 26th of August, and Thames Water is planning one in the coming weeks.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghodde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of the speech delivered on January 23, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the eulogists of the household of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa ali on the occasion of the anniversary of the birth of Lady Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alaiha.
A hay'at is a social unit and institution that pivots around love for the household of the Prophet. The basis for the formation of this small or big institution is the love for the household of the Prophet and guiding towards their goals. This is the truth about and the nature of hay'ats. They first took form during the time of the Imams themselves. This is not something that has been established today or was established in the recent past. It was the companions of the Imams who first established hay'ats. They used to gather after the event of Karbala. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam asked a narrator of traditions, "Do you sit together and speak about us?" The narrator answered, "Yes." Those gatherings were the basis for the formation of hay'ats.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Later, the Imam stated, "I love such gatherings. May we be sacrificed for his love and his heart." He said, "I love such gatherings and you must keep our issue alive." The Arabic word amrana was frequently used by the Imams. It means our issue. It is the fundamental issue on the basis of which we move and act. If we want to use modern words, although this may detract from its true meaning to some extent, we should say that amrana means our path in our school of thought. Ihya amrana means keep our path in our school of thought alive. There is another narration in the book Al-Kafi which says, "Remind one another of our issue and keep it alive." So, the hay'ats date back to that time and they have continued in the history of Shia. It might have taken on different forms. If researchers study this, they can find more details. But they have continued until they reached our time. In certain periods in history, they have been greatly effective, such as during the time of the revolution. You young people do not remember this. During the time of the revolution, the hay'ats were very effective. They distributed astonishing elegies in the form of cassettes throughout the country. For example, an elegist would read an elegy in Jahrom or in Yazd, and it would become very popular.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.